Well, greetings and salutations, everyone. This is another episode of the Limar Technical Net. This, I guess, is our Grammy / April Fool's edition. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. The TechNet has been going strong for 40-odd years and continues in that fine tradition. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual link. Okay, if you need to reach me and you can't get me here on the radio, then email is a good idea. That would be either if you have questions for the technical net, we call those mailbag questions, or if you have topics for discussion. Now, that might be topics that you would like to have a hand in discussing, or do an entire presentation if you're so inclined, or that you want to throw out to me and the other participants to discuss. Also, if you have any kind of interesting puzzles, I have a few little puzzles for tonight in vain of it being near April Fool's Day. So if you have any technical puzzles, so that's another good reason. And if you want me to tap Paul, WX2N, on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space or NASA-related story and comment, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Of course, you can email Paul directly. That would be the spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have a whole bunch of interesting links of interesting articles that I've seen throughout the week at YouTube and all kinds of fun stuff, and some of it is related to some of the puzzle questions tonight. That's on my link page, which is available 24/7. You just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my link page. We have a chat room. It's been very active the last few weeks. You can either go to Limar's own website, find the link to the chat room and click that, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring it directly to our chat room. We have an audio stream for those people who can't listen to us either through IRLP or the radio or Echo Link. You can do it through the internet. You just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you an audio stream. And I try to maintain that throughout the week. So if you're out of radio distance or you don't have a radio on hand, but you have a cell phone or something that's connected to the internet, you just type in technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, I want to remind people, MikeKC2NJI has a great archive of the technical net. His archive site, which is amateurradio.tv, with over a million visitors, has archives of the Limar Technical Net going as far back as September of 2006. So when you have a chance, and check it out. A lot of interesting wisdom from people who either have moved away or unfortunately become silent keys. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you my plans for tonight.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I just made it. How do you like that? Anyway, plans are for a usual technical net. I will ask people for questions of a technical nature. I would prefer if the first few entries are amateur radio related. We can always get to other science questions. I'm open to discuss any technical or scientific concepts, and I have many very clever participants here listening to me and talking on the technical net. If I have any medical questions, as long as it's not diagnostic or treatment, we don't do either on the radio, or any kind of science questions. But I would prefer if we could save those for a later portion of the technical net and have the first few questions be amateur radio related. As I mentioned, I have a few puzzles if we have the time, and I sense the inclination of the audience to play around with a couple of thought puzzles. I will offer them when they seem appropriate. So that's the plan. I also have a little correction to make. I try not to make egregious errors. Sometimes I do. And I'll let it drop and come back and tell you that I was wrong about something that I mentioned last week and a correct an answer to a question that Paul left, WS2N, last week. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. Last week, Paul asked, when you upgrade your license, does it reset your expiration date? Now, I've never upgraded my license, so I don't have practical experience, but I've read things on the Internet, which can be dangerous. And sure enough, there are entries on the Internet that say, yes, you reset your expiration date when you upgrade your license. But upon further investigation, it would appear that that was not particularly correct. If you are not changing your call sign, and you are simply upgrading, say, from tech to general, or general to extra, or any permutation thereof, it does not reset your expiration date. That's the bad news. The good news is the FCC is instituting a $35 policy. When you upgrade your license, you do not have to pay that $35. The only time you pay $35 is if you are if you're changing your call sign, if you're renewing your license. But for changes in privileges, increased privileges, do not require a $35 FCC payment. You still probably have to pay the VE team that's giving you the test, if it's a VE team that's associated with the ARRL, that's $15. There are VE teams that do testing for free. So that's the correction, and also the addition that this new aspect of the $35 fee was just made public this week. So if you're going to upgrade, you don't have to pay the $35.
WS2N.
That this is a little bit too much, but I think, you know, 35 seems a little reasonable. Yeah, upgrading every single time with $35 seems a little bit much, but at least they're not really looking to do that.
Yes, Greg. Paul, you wanted to say something?
I think I doubled. Roy?
Yes, Paul, you wanted to say something about this. I'm sorry that I gave you the wrong information.
No problem, and I'm excited to see details come out little by little from the ARRL. So if you're a member and you sign up for their regular emails, I'm starting to see real clarifications on that, you know, how to pay, or that was another question I had. Not on this net, but, you know, about checks, you can't send the check in. You know, so it's different information. So if you get a chance to, you know, if you're one of these people that don't read all your emails, the ARRL wants to, for now, I would start reading them, make sure you keep up with whatever they're coming out with. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Apparently, they're going to set up a particular page on the FCC database site that you'll be able to pay your $35. I don't know. I would assume it's going to be linked to a credit card, but who knows? We'll find out soon enough. N2SPG in the chat room mentions that you need to pay the VE fees. That don't go away. Yeah. Again, it sort of depends upon the VE team that you choose. There are VE teams out there that do it for free. ARRL doesn't. ARRL puts a $15 fee. You can take all three exams that day and still not pay more than the initial $15. If you fail the test and want to take it a second time during the same visit, every additional time that you have to take the same test over is going to cost you $15. But there are other options where you don't have to pay for VE testing, and it's very nice that people volunteer to do that as well. Anyway, any comments before we begin the McGee?
Question, K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
The ARRL always used to notify me when my license has to be renewed and renewed it for me. Are they going to do that again, or there's no word out yet? Over.
As far as I'm aware, there is no news about them, kind of handling the payment for you. So I guess it's really they're going to have to take a deep look of what they can do for you and what they can't. And they may be able to partially renew your license and then give you the link to pay the bill. But that's still, as far as I'm aware, up in the air. I read everything I get from the ARRL, and they really haven't addressed that aspect of this new change in the rules.
Okay, thank you. Keep us informed.
I will do that. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limar Technical Net, so we're going to be taking people's questions. Again, if you got an amateur radio related one, try and check in early. If it's a general science or medical question, give the people with antenna questions or such a chance to check in first, so that we can kind of hit the road running. So with that in mind, please, everyone out there with any questions of a technical nature, give me your first name and your call sign.
K2UAH, K2UAH. November, Quebec, one uniform. Wayne, KD2UDU.
Okay, I have Wesley, I have Rocco, I have John, and I have Wayne. Anyone else wants to put their name on the list, please hit that push-to-talk button.
Jim, KD2VHD. Rich, W2BC.
Okay, very good. I now have Jim and I have Rich. So hopefully we're going to have a busy night. I hope it doesn't turn out that most of you guys just wanted to support the net. I hope you got questions or topics or comments or what have you. So we will start at the very beginning, which tonight is Wes, N2XJN. What's your set of questions or topics for tonight, Wes?
Yeah, we have the abbreviations or the slang that is being used or the terms that are being used in ham radio. Those are capacitance heads, loading coils, loaded antenna. And starting from the first one, who can explain what is capacitance head? Capacitance head in terms of the antenna. Interaction.
By the way, I just clicked on that third link that you sent me, and it says 404, not found.
That's interesting. If you go to antenna loading presentation, September 2015, which is in the title, that should bring you to the PDF or antenna loading presentation, September 2015.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I think it would be easier if you just resend me the link with the proper address. And if it looks like people need to share it, I can do that. I don't have a lot of free time to look around websites right now.
Give me 10 seconds.
Okay, very good. I'll give you 10 seconds. Give me an opportunity to read the rest of the chat room tonight. Hopefully it'll be nice and busy as well. You know, it's interesting. You know, there are some nights that the chat room is rather quiet and circumspect, and other times when it's busted out. So it can be very entertaining at times. So people out there, if you do have a computer nearby, you know, check in, take a look, see if it suits you. If not, so be it. But otherwise, you know, it'll be fun.
I found the error. When I was placing two links for the number three, the first one was from QSC of 1956. Absolutely amazing article. And then, right behind that, after the word 1956, it was the HTMP. So all it was needed to is just HTMP ://:// whatever is there, and that's antenna loading presentation from 2015. So those are two links there. Enter again.
Okay, give me a second, and I'll try and cut this Siamese twin in parts apart and see what I can get. Okay, I got the. It looks like it's a presentation that someone must have given at a talk. Okay. Anyway, you want to discuss antennas? So I guess the general concept that we probably should set up is that probably the best antenna is one that's inherently resonant, both mechanically and electronically. And what we're now going to end up talking about is when they're not mechanically resonant. And for one reason or another, we've decided to cut the size to a smaller size. A resonant antenna, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, is an antenna that has no excess capacitance or inductance. It has a pure resistance. Most of it is a radiation resistance. And where all the energy is transferred not into thermal heat, but into radio frequency emissions in our attempt to talk to each other. So as we shortened it, we increased the capacitive reactance of the radiating element and take it out of resonance, so we have to do something to deal with the excess capacitance. And there are two major ways that people have found to do it. If you don't mind, I'd rather touch on the second one before the first one, because the second one is what almost everyone uses.
Go ahead, Dr. Roon. You're going to do it faster and better.
Okay. The usual thing that all of us either own or have friends who own are a loaded coil shortened antennas. This is where you introduce additional inductance into your antenna to neutralize the shortened antenna's excess capacitive reactance. You can put the loading coil any place and it will work electronically. You can put it in the base, you can put it in the middle, you can put it in the top. The problem is, mechanically speaking, because it's a heavier piece of metal than most of the antenna, it's mechanically more stable to put it as low down towards the base as possible. This is probably the worst position, though, for the electronic characteristics of a loaded coil shortened antenna, because that's where the currents are the highest, and so current losses are going to be the highest. So you will sometimes see where they put the coil in the middle or even higher up. Again, this introduces some mechanical problems with the design, and you just have to deal with it if that's what you've done. The problem with a loading coil, although it will bring your antenna back to resonance, is that it increases its Q, which means it decreases its bandwidth, And also, it decreases that radiation resistance that I spoke about. Let me drop for a second, and I'll expand upon that. Okay, a quarter wave ground plane antenna in free space has about a radiation resistance of about 36 ohms, give or take. When you bring it closer to the ground, it goes higher up. So this is radiation resistant. If you have an insertion loss, you know, the connectors and the coax cables and other things that have a non-zero resistance, say a total of 5 ohms, that means that, you know, in the case of that 90% of the energy is turned into RF, hopefully, and only 10% is going to waste heat. This is 5 ohms of regular resistive thermal resistance and 50 ohms of radiation resistance. Now, if you put a loading coil, you're decreasing the radiation resistance. You know, you could, in some severe cases, if you get a short antenna, if you take an antenna and it's meant for 80 meters and you shrink it down to 6 feet, it's going to need a heck of a loading coil in order to offset the additional capacitance of such a short antenna. So the amount of radiation resistance plummets from 50 ohms to something like, I don't know, 10 ohms, 5 ohms. So that 5 ohms of insertion loss goes from a 10% loss to a 50% loss or more. So the big problems, as I see it, of loading coils is it decreases radiation resistance, which unless your antenna system is designed for JPL, it decreases your efficiency and it narrows your bandwidth. Let me drop for a second. Now, I guess the best approach is to take these separately. So if anyone has any comments they'd like to make or questions or corrections on loading coil, please feel free.
AD2DK, you're spot on so far. Keep going, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, John. I appreciate it. Okay, we'll move on to capacitance hats, which I have a slightly funny story. Again, as always, I will keep the person in question anonymous, although they're a silent key these days. A gentleman at one of my other clubs was planning to copy a design from an ARRL book, and it was a very curious design. It had what looked like radials on the top instead of on the bottom. And I asked him, what are those? I think I had my license for about 3 or 4 weeks at that point. And he said, they're radials. They're just upside down. Well, they weren't radials. They're things called capacitive hats. And this is another way of getting away with a shortened antenna. It has pluses, but it has minuses. The pluses is it, too, will resolve the extra capacitance of a shortened antenna. And it will not decrease the radiation resistance. So you will have the same efficiencies, or close to the same efficiencies, as the full-length antenna. So that's a good thing. The bad and the queue isn't terribly affected, I believe. So you'll have a decent degree of bandwidth. The big problem is mechanically it's a big pain in the backside because rather than just having a spring at the base of your antenna, which is very easy to design for stability, you have this hat with at least 2 metal rods going in the opposite direction, and in some cases it's a much more complicated affair where I've seen people put together a kind of hexagonal structure as the capacitive hat on top of a shortened antenna. Those can be very difficult to maintain. You whack it against the tree and it's gone. So it has benefits, but it has structural problems. So that's as far as I could give you a very simple explanation of the difference between capacitive hats and loading coils. And yeah, if someone tells you that it's an upside down radial, pat them on the head and give them a cookie.
Some addition to that. Okay. So if you have a screwdriver antenna, just as an example, that resonates at 29.950 megahertz with the 3 feet long radiator, adding the head to the top will bring resonance to just above 18.3 megahertz. This will make 17 meters below and below more efficient and increase the radiation resistance dramatically. So if we remember that capacitive reactance is being handled by head, and loading coils give us inductive reactance, then you could use those two techniques to easily trim your antenna. Also, let me drop. Super efficient, ultralight, very strong, with very little wind loading for its size. Those are the heads usually that we could find, because it could be made from aluminum and mesh. It doesn't have to be steel mesh, it could be aluminum mesh, it's up to you. Dr. Roy.
Okay, what you described is kind of a mixed picture. The screwdriver is basically a variable loading coil. It has an inductor and a shorting bar and a motor, and as you adjust the motor, it winds up and down, shorting or extending the length of the coil and decreasing or increasing the inductive reactance. So there are all kinds of different way of combining them. I've seen people talk about putting a loading coil at the top, at the tip of the antenna, and then introducing a capacitive hat right above the loading coil. All those permutations work. Again, the problem as I see it is, at least functionally, electronically, capacitive hats beat out loading coils all the time, simply because of the benefits of the radiation resistance. But you stuck with the mechanical problems, and that's usually the same reason why the loading coil is usually designed in the worst place it could be on the antenna, which is at a base. You know, if you've ever seen mobile antennas, almost every single time, you know, there are occasional coils in the middle of the antenna, but overwhelming, they seem to be at the base of the antenna. So, you know, that's the extra 2 cents I throw in for this subject.
Okay, and we had 3 points in it. Let me check it. Okay. Yes. So with the emails, I believe you put them on your web page. I'm sorry. That was me. Probably wasn't heard. Okay. I was playing with the antenna switch. Because of right now, I have a Yagi antenna that is directly going to the repeater with 5 watts booming in it, but I didn't finish the installation. That was because we had a problem with some gentlemen who didn't behave properly before. So five watts is probably plenty enough right now. Okay, we have in the article for QST 1953, that's the the link that you couldn't read, but then finally were able to load it. You have it two terms, folded and loaded. So we went through the capacitive head, which would be the handling capacitive reactance. Then we went to the loading coil, which is the screwdriver antenna, but we treated it with also capacitive head. And then we find out that the frequency drops. But now we have a situation where we have a folded and loaded, or folded or loaded. And I sent you the last link, Dr. Roy, pick up.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. They go into different varieties. They discuss coils, which we talked about. They discuss capacitive hats, which we discussed. They mention helical antennas, which is really just a interesting case for a totally loaded coiled inducting radiator. And also they mention folded design as another way of effectively having something packed into a smaller space, but having electronic length. So, all those things are possible. You're not going to see stubs or linear adjustments in most mobile, portable, simple designs, again, because coils are the quickest, easiest, and mechanically at least stable versions of a radiator that's too short and has to be electronically lengthened.
You're right. The only thing is that I pointed at folded dipole. Loaded doesn't mean folded. And a folded dipole is another yet way of getting antenna smaller. But physically, the antenna is actually very much comfortable. So the folded dipole is the antenna which in which two conductors connected to both sides of the folded to form a cylindrical closed shape to which feed is giving at the center. The length of the dipole is half of the wavelength, and it is called a halfway folded dipole antenna. And that was something that you were talking a few times in the past, Dr. Roy.
I mean, people do that. There's all kinds of permutations. I think at one point, Antonio's one of his last antenna designs was one that was made in New England that was basically a folded dipole. So, they work reasonably well. Probably most amateur radio operators are most familiar with loading coils as the means of electronically lengthening a shortened antenna. But all the others do work. They function reasonably well.
The interesting factor about folding or folded dipole is it operates from the frequency from 3 kilohertz to 300 kilohertz. And they were mostly using television receivers at that time. We talk about the reactivity of folded dipole. It is antenna, it is bidirectional, and the input impedance is usually higher. Dr. Ray.
I would kind of doubt that bandwidth for resonance might be within operation of a receiver, because receivers, as has been discussed for most of the 40 years on the technical net, are much more forgiving of standing wave ratios. But that's way too broad a bandwidth for, in my opinion, folded antennas. So those are not transmission bandwidths. They might be received bandwidth, again, because of the promiscuity of receivers. They'll take anything. So you can get away with murder on a receiver. You can't get away with that much murder on a transmitter.
I absolutely agree with that. However, dimension 2 kilohertz to 300 gigahertz for the positive dipole frequency range is not a bandwidth. It's the frequency range. So the antenna has to be built in about or in around the desired frequency range, and then it can deliver. I'm very much interested with very low frequencies from 3 kilohertz to 25 kilohertz, and that's for VLF. But most of the people would not. The good thing is that you could have a perfectly working 2-meter antenna or 17 centimeters antenna, and that would be folded dipole as well if you wish. Dr. Roy.
Okay, so when you were discussing that frequency range, you weren't discussing the bandwidth of a given antenna. You were just saying that that antenna is designed, can be built for any frequency in that range, and that's sort of the same for almost any antenna. I don't know of an antenna that it might become a mechanical obstruction. You know, you could make a half-wave dipole for the very low frequency. You would need a lot of wire and a lot of posts and a lot of land, but you could scale it up. So usually it's not electronic qualities inherent in the design of antennas that limits the size. It's more the mechanical properties of maintaining its structural integrity.
The purpose of the subject that I brought today into XCN was just to talk a little bit about antennas that act as a big guys, big boys, but they are not. And they operate as a big boys, but they are not. So all of the types of the antennas in the links are with point in mind that we want to have a small antenna and we want it to operate as a big one because we don't have the real estate needed for it. Dr. Roy.
Okay, well, that certainly is an option. Again, you get some problems when capacitive hats are going to add some structural instabilities. Again, you can do the coils. A lot of people use a lot of coils. Usually, to get the widest bandwidth, most amateur radio operators don't want to have antennas that are resonant at one side of the band versus the other side of the band. In their perfect world, each of their antennas, at the very least, are reasonably tunable across the high to low of each band. So as you shorten these antennas and play multiple little tricks to get away with things, inevitably you tend to find that the Q rises and the bandwidth drops, and then you have to introduce antenna tuners, which are impedance matching circuits externally that introduce some insertion losses, and life unfortunately gets complicated. But life is a compromise. I think if I could, somehow put up a 200-foot tower with phased array Yagis, multi-band, without being shut down by the FAA, and it's just not costing that much, and not cost that much to maintain it, I think we all would kind of like to play like the big boys. We don't. We play like the little boys. I have a band dipole. It's fine. It's not great. But it's fine, it's tolerable, and, so we reach our own compromises, especially in the metropolitan area where you don't have a lot of land. We can't build antenna farms around here, so we settle.
I believe we have a line of people waiting for their questions and answers or subjects to discuss, but I would like to go to a few descriptions of what we were talking about. So, let me jump. We're talking about loading coil, and we're talking about electrically small antennas. So let's start from loading coil. It is an inductor that is inserted into an electronic circuit to increase its inductance. It was somewhere near 19th century for inductors where they used the technique that was preventing signal distortion in long-distance telegraph transmission cables, and the term was also used for inductors in radio antennas. Okay, the second one. The electrically small antenna. It is not that you have a quarter wave. You could have 1/2000 of the wavelength, and it's going to work. The technique is being used very much, particularly in frequencies 30 kilohertz, 20 kilohertz, and the technology was also tested by Marines for communication with submarines. But the term is for electrically small antenna is that it is an antenna much shorter than the wavelength of the signal. It is intended to transmit or receive. Electrically short antennas are generally less efficient and more challenging to design than longer antennas, such as quarter wave, halfway antennas. And here we have something that comes up as a term, and it's just a little question to Dr. Roy. Ham radio operators don't have to concentrate on it. Let me jump. Okay. The problem is that with electrically small antennas at certain points, we're dealing with evanescent modes. Dr. Roy, do you know by the chance what evanescent mode stands for and applies to Antuxian?
No, I do not, Wesley. I assume that that's a kind of old expression. I could be totally wrong.
Well, a lesson. I had a legitimate question, so maybe some other time. Thank you.
We just finishing. Another 20 seconds and we're finishing with Dr. Roy. Evanescent mode is the use for waveguides at certain points. The electrically short antenna behaves better than in waveguides. So it is the mode that will only propagate it down waveguide if the excitation frequency is larger than cutoff on frequency. So, for example, the frequency can be normalized so that the cutoff frequency is the same as the mode number for the N1, let's say, mode propagation accuracy when the frequency is greater than 1. Thank you very much. And there was a gentleman who had a question. Dr. Roy.
Okay. I unfortunately wasn't able to ID the gentleman who kind of was running out of time. I'm assuming it might be Rocco, but I could be wrong. So the person who kind of said he's running out of time, please ID.
Roy, it's Wayne, KD2UDU. I'm going to have to go to bed soon, so I'm not even next on the list. So maybe another time, all right? Thank you.
Well, let me ask Rocco and John. Do you mind if we take Wayne ahead of you because he has to leave?
KD2UAH, Rocco. No, boy, please, let him go ahead. Because I was just going to give an update. I had a couple more questions about my 9700. But Wayne sounds like he had a legit question. That was an interesting conversation about antennas. I'll let it drop. So please let him go, and I'll defer until next week, because I may go to bed a little early myself. So please let Wayne go ahead. KD2UAH, back to the next.
Okay, Wayne. If you would like to ask your question, you're free to.
All right, Roy. Thank you, Rocco. My question really is more of a protocol question. I recently activated two parks. I was on vacation down in Florida, and I activated two parks with the, you know, the POTA activation. And I gave my regular call sign that I use up here, but I was in Florida. So the first part of the question is, should I have said that KD2UDU/zone 4? And the other part of the question is, should I have created a different log? I log with QRZ. Should I have specifically for zone 4?
Okay. In the good old days or the bad old days, area numbers meant a great deal. So if you left Siouxland, you would have to ID, according to the FCC, as slash mobile or portable 4 if you were going to the area, the number 4 area. That was done away with 20 years ago. So legally, as far as the FCC is concerned, you no longer have to identify what area you're in or whether you are mobile or stationary. For the sake of other contesters, it's always nice as a, you know, just it's nice to do to identify that that you're portable in 4 area, but your call sign is based in 2. And whether or not you really need to identify that, I don't really think so. Since you're activating from a particular area, hopefully they understand that you have to be in that area to activate that area. So although it's nice to do that, I don't think it's particularly required. Now, if anyone out there knows of any esoteric rules of the law with activating sites that's no different than my conjecture, please hit that push-to-talk button. Okay, no response. So, again, I would say it's a pleasantry to ID yourself the old-fashioned way with portable 4, but the FCC doesn't require it, and I would assume the organizations that maintain parks on the air doesn't.
Hi, Roy. I thank you. So you don't think it's necessary to create a separate log for that also, then, I guess?
No. If you were in some kind of test, a contest, where your location could be obscured and confusing, and some contests will not allow you to operate remotely from things to kind of cheat everyone else. But if you're activating a site, you have to physically be on the site to activate it. So it goes without saying that even though you carry a 2 area number, that you activated it in the area of that park. So I don't think that you would need to. If anything, it would probably confuse the heck out of the record keeping.
Roger that, Roy. Yeah, I was pretty consistent telling everybody that I was at certain park, the designated number that POTA gives out for each park. All right, well, thank you, Roy. I'm sorry I barged in. Wesley can be very long-winded, and, I don't have a lot of time. So thank you very much for letting me cut the line.
You're welcome, Wayne. Eventually, I'll come up with some kind of a better system where, I'll kind of give people the option of going fast track, slow track, and such. But I got to give it some more thought. So, you're welcome. Thanks for participating tonight, Wayne.
Roy, 73.
73 to you as well. Rocco, if you're still around, if you're not around, I'll understand, but if you're still around, if you still have a comment to make, please feel free. Okay, I guess Sirocco has to leave. John, NQ1U, what's your question or comment for tonight?
Yeah, thanks. One thing I wanted to mention before my question, which is, by the way, directly related to everything you said about small antennas and complicated small, but that's a wonderful thing. Correct me, please, if I'm wrong, but I thought I heard a comment last week that said that light is bent around massive objects. And the last time I had coffee with Albert Einstein, I used to call him Al. He would call me who? Anyway, the last time we had coffee together, my understanding was that light doesn't get bent around because of gravity. Space-time gets bent around, and light just hangs in there. Any comment on that? Am I right about that?
Well, yes, you're right. It depends sort of on how you perceive gravity. There's a little bit of a problem reconciling quantum gravity with relativity gravity. But by Einstein's way of reckoning, it's not that the light is twisted. It's that space-time is twisted and light thinks it's following a straight line. But there are other weirdnesses related to light, which hopefully we will get to with tonight's little puzzler. If you happen by my link page, I have a picture of two radiometers, and hopefully I'll have an opportunity to discuss how those things work.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, here's the question. I have access. Most of the time, I live in a place that has about a 10-foot by 10-foot wooden deck 15 feet off the ground and no capability for anything hanging from trees. And so, yes, I need a small antenna for HF. And I was thinking about one of these hand-stick things screwed together to make dipoles. And I know that Q is going to be there and it's going to really give me a narrow operating range. So the question is, does anybody have any experience, given the great theory discussion that preceded, about what would be a good way to try to put some HF antennas in a ridiculous wooden platform that I have to work from?
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
Good evening, gentlemen. In my experience with mobile WIP antennas, instead of ham sticks, I used a pair of Shark mobile antennas because they're really inexpensive, you know, and I wanted to try. And I realized that on 40 meters, I only got a 40 kilohertz of bandwidth for resonance. And on 20 meters, I think it was like 60 or 80, something like that. You know, and I used it even inside my apartment, and I was able to make contacts, you know. I'm wondering if there's a way to educatedly experiment with these things to get the optimal result. Go ahead.
I've heard of Shark, haven't used him, don't know anything about him, but when you say experiment, I guess you mean just get one and try it out. That's certainly a good thought.
Well, you know, you want it to be in the clear if you can, you know, without as high up as possible. And, you know, how to say, the Shark antennas, they fit into the hamstick dipole mount. So, you know, same thread on there.
Well, what I don't have access to is any place to use counterpoise. So I would be sitting on this wooden 15 by 15 foot deck. What do you think of that?
But you do have a counterpoise. One of the antenna, one side is the poise and the other side is the counterpoise. Go ahead.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, that's great. Thanks. I appreciate the comment. Zach Kness, this is NQ1U, John.
Yeah, I would rather not kind of call one a counter and the other a poise or something like that. It basically, what you're doing is you're using shortened dipoles. So, in other words, you would have to, theoretically, for the best approach, you would have a bunch of dipoles kind of coming out of a ball socket, and, you know, one would be for one band, another going off at another angle would be for another band, and on and on and on, as much as you can group them together. As far as I'm aware, the shark kind of works the same way. Maybe David knows better than I. It's a loaded coil shortened antenna system, so you're going to have the decreased radiation resistance, the higher Q. But, you know, like I said before, everything is a compromise. In addition, although I think we've discussed this in the past, in addition to a shortened loaded antenna, you might want to consider a magnetic loop. Again, I've known people who've done reasonably well with them. They have a very high Q and require incessant tuning. But they don't have great height requirements, and sometimes they work in the pit.
Yeah, these are good comments. I really appreciate it. Thanks very much. I guess that's really the only questions I had. I'll stand by. This is NQ on you.
Okay, very good, John. If anyone else out there has any suggestions, please feel free to hit that push-to-talk button.
This is George, KD2FIU. I'd like to get the call sign of the person who just called in with the 15x15 deck.
Yeah, it's NQ1U, John.
November, Quebec, one uniform.
You guys doubled.
November, Quebec, one uniform.
Email me your contact, radiofever@att.net. I'd like to know more about your 15x15 deck because I got some really good suggestions for 10, 15, and 20 meters. Very good coverage.
Appreciate it. Radiofever@att.net. Thank you.
NQ, come back with that. NQ1 what?
Uniform. November, Quebec, one uniform, or nobody questions one underwear.
Right. This is George, and what's your first name?
John, Juliet, Oscar, November.
Very good. NQ1U, KD2FIU. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, George, and John, I hope you have success, and please, when you set something up and have an opportunity to test it out, come back and tell us your success story.
Well, I will be probably doing it on electronically because it'll be in Park City, Utah.
Okay, wherever, when you get back, or there's always Echo Link.
Yeah, that's what I mean. By the way, has anybody had any problem with Echo Link, the ports that you need on the computer, creating any openings for hacking? Any risks there?
Personally, I haven't had any problems. I port forward the necessary ports, and I haven't really seen any attacks on those ports, personally. You shouldn't open them wide all over the place, but, I've been doing it for 10 years now, so it's not really a problem, at least as far as I've seen.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Wenyu.
Okay, very good. Thanks, John, for participating. Next on our list tonight is Jim, 82VHD. What's your question or topic or comment for tonight, Jim? Rich, is that you? You're rather noisy tonight.
What?
Yes, David.
put me at the end of the list, please?
Yes, certainly.